Accession number 29075, reel 13.
Well, I wonder whether there was ever a better time, I don't know. But everything was under attack. The Conservative government, or the Treasury at the time, was being very hostile. It must have been Nigel Lawson's time, I think. And everything was under question. And give them a chance, and it was up for grabs to be taken away. They tried, for instance, to get at the Navy's non-public funds. In other words, the private funds of ships, the ship welfare fund and all that sort of thing, and either make the Navy pay for the cost, you know, separately as a cash sum for the cost of administering them, or drop those sort of funds altogether. They tried to say, oh, well, they only need to be audited once a year. That's all a business needs. Well, you know, we all knew that the rate that a ship's company turns over, always people are coming and going, you couldn't have it on a year basis. And there had been established a four-monthly audit cycle, and that had to go on. But one had to fight these sort of silly non-battles time and time again. Actually, we prevailed on most of them, and I think when I left, the general administration of people matters was a little bit better than when I'd got there, but some of the things I really wanted to achieve were limited. The change to all the service documentation we didn't achieve in my time, although I had 3 years, what I wanted, because it was frustrated at so many different turns. But nevertheless, it was heading in the right direction. And one of the crucial issues was the retention of sailors and indeed of officers. And I was put in charge of a thing called the Retention Working Party, which was drawn from all branches of the naval staff and everything else. And the idea was to avoid doing things that were going to drive sailors out of the Navy, because sailors could give 18 months notice and go. And I think in this, we were successful. What was interesting, though, was the way statistics were presented to us. And I had to fight for it, but I got it in the end, that actually the best measure of how well we were doing in retaining people was to compare the average length of service of people. Because otherwise the numbers would be fluctuating and it's difficult to compare apples and oranges. But doing it on this average length of service basis, we actually realised then how good we were and indeed, you know, how bad we were in certain ways. And this became a very valuable yardstick. I'm just so sad that when I asked this question about that a couple of years ago when I was at a meeting, they don't bother about it anymore. But because actually it was a very good indicator. They're still as worried about retention now as they were when I was there. But the Retention Working Party did smooth out certain sort of minor problems. I mean, it was nothing very dramatic. Another area that I was much involved with was shore accommodation and then the design of ship accommodation. And the shore accommodation it was a contribution to the decisions taken under the Director of Quartering, who was the chap who was really responsible, but it was, you know, what the standards should be, and in particular where places had already been built, where they standards might be slipping, either due to maintenance or so. In the same way as I'd had really quite a lot to do with the maintenance side when I was at Portsmouth, I returned to it as DNSC. And, I mean, the job of DNSC does require someone who's had a very broad experience, and all of the various things I'd done throughout my career seemed to come together. I think that was a good thing. With regard to ship accommodation, I mean, sometimes the designers down at Bath did silly things, like putting a mess deck in one place and their bathroom miles away and up and down two ladders in order to get there. Well, you hope to get in on the design phase early enough to get that sort of thing put right. And indeed we did. And we contributed a bit to refit programs and that sort of thing. The difficulty with that sort of a job, which was an influence job rather than a responsibility and authority job, is actually making sure that you can get your oar in at the right time, which is best done by the people who are responsible turning and asking for your advice at the time. But the way things go, people being people, they're focused on what they are doing, and they tend to forget issues like the ones that I was interested in. But in the shore accommodation, I mean, I had, having been in the job for a year and a half nearly, I realised that some of it was very poor in its carpeting and that sort of thing, and I was looking for ways in which this could be done. And suddenly, quite unexpectedly, in about mid-February one year, we were asked for bids for things that we could do that we could spend the money by the end of the year. And basically, I recarpeted the Navy in all of the sailors' accommodation blocks. Not every single last one, obviously, but we spent somewhere about 6 or 8 million on carpet. It was absolutely standard stuff. There was nothing fancy about it. But it was clean, and by Jove, it was so much better than what it was replacing, which had had dirt and grease and that sort of thing tramped into it for years, and much of it was in a condition where it was uncleanable. Anyway, so that was a minor triumph that one had. I used to have to talk to commanding officers going to sea and tell them the things that were going on, and then what they, in turn, should look out for, and when they got a problem, the way through the system, because we were very happy to take problems in direct without coming all picking all the way up the chain of command. But it was it was a varied and interesting job. I used to go to sea occasionally, which was more value for me than for the people I visited, I suspect. But it was certainly the sort of thing that kept one focused and motivated. And I did this job for 3 years, and towards the end of it I was told that I was not going to be promoted to Rear Admiral, which was disappointing in its way. But there was no job actually coming up that I could have gone for anyway, so whatever I might have gone would have been a non-job, and they were beginning to promote only into vacancies, not in accordance with career factors. And so I retired at the beginning of 1989.
Was there anything in particular that was a cause of people leaving the Navy before their time, as it were?
Well, there are a variety of factors, and so much depended upon the individual and their needs. Family reasons, the wife wanting him out, or children. And mostly it was actually the amount of time being spent in ships and at sea, and we knew that we were going to have to develop various strategies to overcome this, because ships weren't going to run any less intensively, particularly as it was inevitable that the number of ships was going to be reducing. And where they have got to, we'd started the thinking of this process, but it was a good few years before they devised the new sort of manning system, which in a way is like Polaris, where you have two entirely separate crews. They don't do that in the surface fleet anymore now. What they do is they overman. So shall we say a ship is, as a ship's company of 125% of the billets, and 25% of the ship's company is then on leave, must be less than 25% actually, but on leave and undergoing training and that sort of thing, which does actually give people greater predictability of life. The sort of thing that really cracks sailors, and it always has, cracks sailors around a little, is when there is no definite program, nothing around which they can plan, or when they get a plan, something then happens and it all changes. And now, what they're doing, you know, when a chap's time for relief to go on leave or to go on a course comes up, they fly somebody else in to replace him. Well, that didn't happen like that in my day. But we were beginning to realise that that was the sort of solution that had to be found. In fact, the Navy had to do a major study to work out how it should be done. And the chap who did it and led it was the fellow who relieved me, who subsequently went off and drove a carrier. And then when he was a Rear Admiral, he did this particular study. And but there are many different reasons. On the whole, it was personal, but one had to look for the general themes. And basically, it was the intensity at which ships were having to run. Also, when ships were in dockyards, the conditions of the way what was required of the ship's company standing by, the amount of work that was expected to be done by the ship's company instead of by dockyard mateys, because it was regarded as cheaper to do it by sailor than by dockyard matey. Well, the Navy couldn't afford to have this, and so one of the things to do was to negotiate for ships' companies to be reduced. And so, although you'd still leave a skeleton engineering team on board, mainly to supervise and remain, so they knew what was happening in the development as a refit was done, most of the ships' company would go away and then go to proper shore establishments. Before that, ships' companies had been landed to live ashore, as in the barracks at Portsmouth, while their ship was basically empty and they would paddle down in the rain, morning and back in the evening, to work on board. And they had unsatisfactory midday meal arrangements, or they'd have to walk all the way back to barracks, and it was a pretty miserable way of doing things. And we did a number of improvements to that, improving the facilities down in the dockyards so that the midday meal could be better, and providing better recreational and what you might call lounge facilities. And the best of all probably was up at Rosyth, where a building was opened while I was DNSC. For the accommodation of ships' companies refitting, which was really a step change. And then elsewhere we tried to do bits of that to support, to follow the same idea. But it all had to be within what was financially possible, achievable, particularly as we were in a period when, from the financial and the resources point of view, manpower was seen as too expensive and it wasn't salaries, it was all the support costs and everything else. And so that, well, those support costs were being looked at all the time to try and rationalise them, and one had to make sure that the baby didn't go out with the bathwater. So it was interesting, but it became really quite frustrating at times, and it was a job, as I say, of influence rather than authority.
And you retired in January 1989.
That's right.
What then became of you?
Well, I had been very busy, and so I had not paid a great deal of attention, as is the case with many people, to what I was going to do next, except that I knew that I wanted to go and have a follow-on job. I was not going to be able to just retire and live on my pension. One of the things I had discovered in my final years as Director of Naval Service Conditions was that the much vaunted naval pension scheme was actually pretty measly and meagre, particularly when you compared it with what was available on offer in the commercial world and that sort of thing. And
how old were you at this stage, sorry?
I was 54. Rising 54. And I set about applying for jobs. I did the course, and then I did another little course, and I applied for lots of jobs. I had some interviews. I was on the point of being offered one job when I realised that it wasn't me at all. It was a very lonely job. It had a secretary, and really everybody you dealt with was going to be your enemy. You know, the purpose of it was to keep a whole lot of different interests in balance. I thought that was going to be hard row to hoe. I didn't want to have a sinecure, but I really didn't want something which was going to be unduly hostile in my work. I then was on the point of being offered another job, which I turned down because I had been put forward by the Naval Secretary as the Navy's candidate to be the Sergeant at Arms in the House of Commons, which would have been a smashing job. Anyway, I was the runner-up there, which was a great shame. And the fellow who got it was, for the first time in many years, was not an ex-serviceman, but was the retiring High Commissioner in Canada, British High Commissioner in Canada. So, anyway, but I think it was probably a good thing that I persuaded myself that fate had got the right, or my name on the right board. And we went off to Australia to see our daughter as well, who was out there nursing for a couple of years. And when I came back, staging through Hong Kong, there was a telephone call for me that I was wanted urgently, and so I went to see the man who was wanting me urgently, and I was offered a job as general manager of an outfit called the Centre for British Teachers, and that was located in Chancery Lane in London, and it was an organisation that sends teachers overseas, mostly teaching English as a foreign language, but not exclusively that. We had everything from university professors down to primary school teachers on our books, but where they were managed, and we provided them with housing and cars, and there was a proper support. It wasn't, here's your air ticket, go and teach a foreign, speak English. We had about 500 teachers around the world. But the organisation was in some difficulty. It had been highly, highly profitable in the past, particularly when it was doing a lot of teaching in Germany. But we had a principal debtor. We were a £9 million a year turnover business, and we had a debtor who owed us £6 million. The debtor was the government of Brunei. Very difficult because, we eventually, after I'd left, they got the money out of them. There was never any question that it was owed to us, but they were playing internal politics with it too. Also, there was a problem over the rental, because where we were, they were about to more than treble the rent. Anyway, we found somewhere down in Reading, and I moved them down there. And with that, and a whole lot of things which we turned the organisation around. But I had decided, before we left London, that really I didn't like the head office of this particular organisation. The teachers out abroad, we had them in Hong Kong, Malaya, Brunei, Oman, Turkey and Germany. They were all super. There were no, the systems worked well with them. The head office was the problem. So I was looking for another job, and I got what became the most wonderful job as the Director of Personnel and Services at the Wellcome Trust, the biggest charity in the UK. In fact, at that time, the biggest charity in the world. And giving money for medical research and quite a lot of associated things as well. Anyway, which was a fascinating job, and I started that in February 91, I think, and I stayed there until I retired in October 99, and that was a really good job. Lots of variety, a lot of responsibility, a big budget that was to be properly spent. The trust was expanding, the number of employees had to increase in order to be able to give these huge grants. They had to be properly assessed and monitored, and the staff multiplied by 4 or 5 times against an increase in income, and thus grants of about 8 times. So, but it did require buildings and that sort of thing. And so many elements of my naval experience all came together in there, both in the personnel side of things and in the buildings, the administration, and then I was also responsible for the history of medicine activities. I didn't do that to start with, but I came to it when the librarian who was responsible, he retired, and the place was reorganised, and I was the one on the executive board who took responsibility for the history of medicine, which I found very interesting, and I had a very, very happy 9 years, 9.5 years there.
After you retired from the Navy, having spent your working life in it, was there any sense of, I suppose, being somewhat adrift in a different world, to us, in a sense?
I know what you mean. I think actually not much. Yes, a bit, most certainly. Because there are sort of protective elements that there are out of the Navy. But I had, working in the Ministry of Defence for my last job, you were just like anybody else going to work in London. And so one had begun to lose the protective shell. And also, there was a huge generation gap between somebody like me in my mid-50s and the average ship's company, which is around the age of 21. Now, actually, that's very good for one, for the older person. It does a lot to keep you young and keeps you up to date in your attitudes, providing you respond in the right way. I think that there was an uncertainty about the future direction of my life. One of the great things about the Navy or the other forces is that you get a wide variety of jobs, such a selection of activities that you're given to do, and you gain experience from all of these, and some of them you do better than others, but still the paycheck is coming in. You don't have that uncertainty. The wife and kids are going to be sufficiently provided for. Well, if you make a failure of it, right, that's the, on the whole, the end of your career advancement, but it doesn't cut you off without a penny unless you've really, been criminal about it or thoroughly, thoroughly incompetent. So there is a security that you have in the services. When you get outside, one of the things that was most marked was everybody's insecurity. Nobody was absolutely safe in the tenure of their job. And I find that, is a shame. It does keep an organisation dynamic, sort of creative insecurity, I suppose. And I'm not saying that the services is necessarily wholly the right approach, but we have certainly, in the services, did have this security, and with that you get a loyalty, because loyalty is a different commodity in civilian life. There is a great deal of it, and it's very much up to the leaders of an outfit to create and inspire that loyalty. But it's not something which is necessarily able to be encouraged by the organisation as a whole. It's rather more personal, usually. I suppose that was the main...